This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, in for Terry Gross.
Ladies and gentlemen, if I say I'm an oil man, you will agree. Now, I've traveled across half our state to be here and to see about this land. I'm a family man. This is my son and my partner, H.W. Plainview. I have many wells flowing at many thousand barrels per day. I can guarantee to start drilling and to put up the cash to back my word.
That's Daniel Day-Lewis as an oil man during the early days of the oil industry in the movie There Will Be Blood. A few months ago, Terry spoke with the film's writer and director, Paul Thomas Anderson. Anderson also made Boogie Nights, Hard Eight, Magnolia, and Punch Drunk Love. He was nominated for 3 Academy Awards this year for writing, directing, and producing There Will Be Blood, which will be released on DVD early next month. The movie is loosely based on the 1927 novel Oil by Upton Sinclair. Daniel Day-Lewis plays a silver prospector who discovers oil, then buys the drilling rights to oil-rich land in rural California by promising poor families he can transform their lives through the money oil will bring. But in one town, he meets a boy preacher and faith healer named Eli Sunday, who also is promising the townspeople he can transform their lives through his direct connections to the Holy Spirit. In this scene, the oil man, Daniel Plainview, is trying to convince the boy preacher and his father to let Plainview drill for oil on their land. The preacher is played by Paul Dano, who co-starred in Little Miss Sunshine as the Silent Brother.
My offer to you is $3,700.
What is it that brought you here, sir?
The good Lord's guidance. Now, of course, within that, we're going to develop a lease. What's that?
What about our oil?
What about it?
We have oil here. That's worth something.
Oh, do you have someone who can drill for it? Do you think there's oil here?
I know there is.
Oh, it's very expensive to drill. You know, to get it up and out of the ground. You ever tried that before?
How much is it?
Costly.
Well, our oil sits right up on top of the ground.
I believe that's called seepage. Doesn't necessarily mean there's anything underneath.
What would you give us for it?
I don't know.
Something you don't know.
That's right. What would you like, Eli?
$10,000.
For what?
For my church.
That's good. That's a good one. Well, if we decide to drill for oil, and if the well begins to produce, I'll give your church a $5,000 signing.
$10,000.
Do you want to find someone else that's going to come up here and drill, Eli? Make the investment and do all the hard work that goes into it?
A little later on, we'll hear Terry's interview with Paul Dano, who plays the preacher. But first, let's listen to her 2007 interview with the writer and director of There Will Be Blood, Paul Thomas Anderson.
Paul Thomas Anderson, welcome back to Fresh Air, and congratulations on the movie. You know, an interesting thing about There Will Be Blood is that there's no real pleasure in the movie. I don't mean in watching the movie, but I mean the characters in the movie have no pleasure. There's very little eating in the movie. There's no sex. There's no entertainment. And even the oil man, who becomes quite wealthy, doesn't seem to be interested in much that money can buy. He's interested in finding oil. That's his obsession. That's all he really seems to care about.
You know, it says something about the men of this period that were kind of on the tail end of the wild, wild west, who started as silver miners and kind of got into the oil business because that's what was happening. You know, that was what was in front of them. They could never really shake that ambition and that drive to work, that what they enjoyed the most was the fever, the insanity, just the process, that actually getting the stuff or the riches from it somehow was really unsatisfying to them. I that's my guess, because so many of them had this incredibly hard time transitioning into the 20th century. You know, they'd have these palatial mansions, but they'd still live like they were living in a tent, you know. So whatever they were after, once they got it, clearly wasn't satisfying their hunger, that they liked being hungry, that they probably preferred being hungry.
The way your movie is, it revolves around two people's stories. One of them is the independent oil man who becomes a millionaire through acquiring all this oil property. And then this boy preacher who's a fundamentalist preacher and claims to be able to get rid of the devil, no matter where the devil is, in the room or in your body. And they're both great salesmen. They both have their pitches down. And they're both completely the opposite of each other in terms of what it is that they're pitching. And I guess what interested you in this dichotomy between the oil man and the boy preacher?
First and foremost, it's a great boxing match.
Yeah.
You know, they start out with their wits and their words, and then they start throwing punches. But just that idea of a boxing match, you know, was so terrific. It's funny because I'd originally thought it would be a good idea. It turned out it was not a good idea, but I had imagined the boy preacher is like 12 or 13 years old, you know, that no matter what Plainview, no matter what age somebody he was faced with, if somebody had his own same line of BS, you know, they were going to be a formidable opponent. We thought better of it. You know, we thought that would be a little bit absurd to have a 12 or 13-year-old boy, but the ideas remain the same, just to get them in the ring together.
There Will Be Blood is set in the late 19th and early 20th century, but the two kind of themes, two of the themes of the movie are so contemporary, you know, corporate obsession and power and religious obsession and power, still two of the driving forces in our country and our culture. I guess you were thinking about that a lot when you made the film.
Yeah, of course, but best to approach it like I said, like a boxing match or like a horror story, you know, rather than kind of this sort of the endless kind of punctuation that you could put on that kind of stuff that's there already. You know, you've got an oil man, you've got a preacher. Let the rest just be a fight to the death.
You had to learn so much to recreate the period, and you had to learn a lot about the early days of oil exploration. Let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, like in the early part of the film, when the Daniel Day-Lewis character is first learning how to dig for oil, I mean, the technology is basically like a bucket on a pulley that he pulls up by hand, and then he deposits the oil on a big puddle by the well.
Yeah, that's it.
And then things kind of grow a little from there. Go ahead.
Not all that stuff just comes from the written descriptions of how Edward Doheny first found oil right near Dodger Stadium near downtown L.A. They talk about starting out. Usually, they were essentially using what they knew as silver miners, which is you dig a hole. And then they realized they were down about, you know, 50, 60 feet, and that they were choking on the fumes. So they said, well, we can't be down here to get this stuff up out of here. How are we going to do it? And they built an A-frame, you know, with a 50-foot eucalyptus tree that they'd shaved down and were just trying to drive it into the ground. I mean, these really primitive techniques. And the funny thing is, as much as it's changed, it's still kind of the same as it is today. It's just driving an enormous pole into the ground over and over and over again until, you know, you poke the monster enough and it erupts. But yeah, we just kind of we were recreating things that had been written down by people that were there, you know, saying we found the oil and we scooped it up with whatever we had, bottles and cans and saucepans, whatever it was. Just that fever to get it up and out of the ground. They didn't even really have a place to put it, so they were just digging holes.
There are some really horrifying accidents that happen during the course of the movie while people are digging for oil. Did you study up on what typical accidents were like in those early oil days?
Yeah, we read about a few, you know, and then they're all so graphic. I mean, there were a few written about in Upton Sinclair's book and then a few just from various other sources that we had. But then when we built the derrick and we got out there and we had this terrific guy named Jim Farmer, who's an old oil man who came out to help us out with some of the details of the drilling. And boy, once we met him, I mean, the stories just came fast and furious, you know. I mean, to the point where you just had kind of had enough. You're like, I don't need to hear about one more accident, you know. But quite honestly, you were aware of the dangers every single second, particularly when you've got a film crew around. You know, just everything was dangerous. The danger that something was going to fall, the danger that your fingers were going to get caught somewhere. I mean, it's horribly dangerous labor, and particularly out there where I think at the time these oil guys worked in 12-hour shifts. So for 12 hours they would work, and then they'd go to wherever the bar was and drink for 10 hours, sleep for 2 hours, probably stop at church on the way in, and then do it all over again, you know. So not only is there the danger just in general, but you factor in booze and heat and all the rest, and it's just, it's amazing.
So is one of the accidents in the movie based on a story that you were told about a real accident or something that you read?
The bit falling, there's a character named Joe Gunda who we meet very briefly. The bits fall, and he's down in a cellar, which is a place where they sort of collect the mud. That was from the Upton Sinclair book where I first read it. And then talking to some of our old-timers and oil guys, they would just tell us endless stories about bits falling, guys drowning in the mud. And maybe they'd get hit in the head by something that fell, and that wouldn't be what killed them. But, you know, drowning in this mud would be the thing that got them. Not to mention the work that they were doing, you know, high up. These derricks are 80 feet tall. So, you know, from time to time people would fall. And then, I mean, and we're not even factoring in what happens when these things do come in. Ideally for them, they knew when they were coming in. They knew they'd sort of hit a certain sand that they were looking at and smelling and saying, okay, we're very close. And they could prepare, however they did prepare, for the gusher to come in. But those times when a gusher would come in, they didn't know it. I mean, you were in trouble. You were in a lot of trouble, particularly if it lit on fire, and anything could light it on fire. Just a rock shooting up out of the ground could be a spark that could catch a flame.
And that happens in the movie, and there's this huge fire that erupts after the gusher starts gushing. And I'm thinking about how challenging that scene must have been to create. First of all, I don't know if an oil fire burns differently than, say, a wood fire or any other fire, and if you had to make sure that you were creating an oil fire so that the fire would look authentic.
Yeah, well, black smoke is the key. You know, oil burns black, and we were using diesel fuel, and it burned pretty darn close to how real crude oil would burn. And we augmented it a little bit with some digital effects, just helping to kind of darken it a little bit, but it sure felt like the real thing when we did it. And, you know, we had a special effects guy, a terrific guy named Steve Kremens, and whose job it was to get thousands of gallons of diesel fuel spouting up in the air and then to light it on fire. And he said to us, you know, I cannot guarantee that I can put this fire out. I can do it and I can turn it off. But once that derrick catches on fire, there's a chance I might not be able to put it out. We thought he was just playing it safe, you know, that would be... But the second we lit the match, it was clear there was no way we were going to be able to put it out because the wood was so dry. It was so much gasoline. And we were essentially forced to do that entire sequence within two takes in about 45 minutes before the derrick tumbled to the ground.
Yeah, and the fire is alive. I mean, so you're shooting something that has a life of its own.
Yeah. It doesn't take direction very well.
Right.
But that's what's fun about it, too. You know, it's great. I mean, we were so nervous leading up to lighting that fire because, first of all, we were in love with our derrick. You know, we're so proud of it. And we knew we were going to be completely melancholy when it was gone. Mixed in with that, we were all completely petrified at the prospect of screwing it up. I mean, what are you going to do? We're not going to build it again. That wasn't going to happen, you know. And obviously, we were pretty careful. We weren't going to do it if the wind was blowing too much. To be really honest with you, it was kind of one of the benefits of shooting out in West Texas because they're a lot looser out there. You know, I don't think we could have done anything like that in California. They would have had a heart attack out there.
There Will Be Blood, Paul Thomas Anderson's 2007 movie about the birth of the oil industry, is still playing in some theaters and is about to come out on DVD. It won two Oscars, for cinematography and for Daniel Day-Lewis's starring role, and was nominated for six others, including Motion Picture of the Year. Our next guest, Paul Dano, gives an incredible performance in the film playing a boy preacher. Daniel Day-Lewis, in an extraordinary performance, plays Daniel Plainview, an oil man at the turn of the century. Plainview is a savvy but not always honest salesman, persuading poor people in California to sell or lease their land to him so he can drill for oil. The oil man promises them prosperity, while the boy preacher, who has started his own church, promises to save people's souls. The preacher and the oil man often are at odds. In this scene, the oil man is preparing to open his new oil well. The preacher walks into the oil man's office and tries to get in on the action.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How is all the work coming?
Everything's good.
All the men are provided for.
Of course.
Spirits seem high. Is there anything that you need from me? Anything the church can do for you?
I don't believe so, no, thank you.
I understand you've asked the people to gather round and watch the well begin tomorrow, is that right?
That's right.
I will bless the well. Before you begin, you should introduce me. You'll see me walk up towards the oil well, and when I begin...
Derek.
You'll see me walk up, and then you could say my name.
When you walk up?
Yes, you'll see me walk up, and then you could say... The proud son of these hills who tended his father's flock. And then you could say my name.
That's fine.
And what happens then?
Well, then we start the drill.
It's a simple blessing, Daniel, but an important one. It's just a few words. It won't take long. What time?
What time's good for you, Eli?
4 o'clock.
Well, let's make it 4 o'clock then. My thanks for your visit.
Good day. Thank you.
Paul Dano, welcome to Fresh Air. This is the second time you've acted opposite Daniel Day-Lewis, and he's an actor famous for the intensity he brings to researching his roles and for inhabiting his characters. Now, your character has to show such like great confidence in the scene we just heard. Did you have that confidence as an actor going up against Lewis in that scene?
Yeah, and I don't say that out of, you know, any sort of arrogance. Rather, I think you have to for the character. I think if you allow yourself to be intimidated or get self-conscious or look for too much approval, it's going to seep into the work. So you really you don't have a choice playing a character like this. You have to sort of go in head first and not look back.
Now, you have such a kind of quiet confidence in the scene. You're telling him kind of quietly, almost in a monotone, you know, like how, what he's going to do and how he's going to do it. Was that an intentional decision on your part to keep it like really quiet to show your power?
I think so. I think there's a charisma to Eli Sunday, the character I play, and there's a certain savviness to him, and I think his demeanor is meant to be seen as sincere as well as powerful. And I think there's a relation to Eli that I saw in the relationship a lot of people have with God, which is that you love God, but you fear God. And I think in the sermons you sort of get that idea where his quiet demeanor leads into something that overtakes him and is a little more forwardly and externally powerful.
Well, like there's one scene, for instance, it's kind of somewhere between a faith healing and an exorcism. You lay your hands on a sick woman and then you're throwing the devil out of her, and you're physically doing it. I mean, you're kind of like physically throwing out this invisible devil. Who did you read about or watch on TV to kind of figure out how you were going to approach that?
Well, I certainly did research for the period and did look up things about evangelical preachers, but here's the privilege I had with this character, Eli. He is a boy who did not have radio or television or internet, for that matter. He did not have a lot of books. He didn't have money to go travel around and see other preachers. Maybe a preacher came to his town or a neighboring town and he did get to go see them. But he's somebody who I think really made himself up. I think he invented himself. I think he's quite a bit of an actor. I think he created a persona at a very young age once he saw religion and his curiosity with religion could do for him, and he was sort of savvy and charismatic and cunning enough to be able to use that, and it manifested itself into this persona that I really think he invented. So as an actor, I had this privilege to really make him up as I saw fit. I did not want to directly emulate anybody in particular. And I think Paul Anderson, who wrote the script as well as directed it, he's just as good a writer as he is a director. And his words and the language were so wonderful that a lot of it, any physicality or anything came from that. It came directly from the words. And I think, channeling that was really the most important thing.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for Broadcasting and Cable Magazine and TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Let's continue our interview with Paul Dano. He plays the young preacher in the film There Will Be Blood, which won 2 Academy Awards for cinematography and for lead actor Daniel Day-Lewis. It soon will be out on DVD. The boy preacher, played by Dano, has started a church where he claims to have a direct line to God and practices faith healing. He's at odds with the oil man, played by Daniel Day-Lewis, who is buying up all the land. Without giving away too much of the story, in this scene, the preacher gets even with the oil man by making the oil man, who has no belief in God, come to the church for a confrontation in front of the congregation.
Daniel, you've come here and you've brought good and wealth, but you have also brought your bad habits as a backslider. You've lusted after women, and you have abandoned your child. Your child that you raised, you have abandoned all because he was sick and you have sinned. So say it now. I am a sinner.
I am a sinner.
Say it louder. I am a sinner.
I am a sinner.
Louder, Daniel. I am a sinner.
I am a sinner.
I am sorry, Lord.
I am sorry, Lord.
I want the blood.
I want the blood.
You have abandoned your child.
I've abandoned my child.
I will never backslide.
I will never backslide.
I was lost, but now I am found.
I was lost, but now I'm found.
I have abandoned my child. Say it. Say it.
I've abandoned my child.
Say it louder. Say it louder.
I've abandoned my child. I've abandoned my child. I've abandoned my boy.
Paul Dano and Daniel Day-Lewis in a scene from There Will Be Blood. Let's get back to Terry's 2007 interview with Paul Dano.
Do you have a favorite story about making the movie?
Let me think for one sec. Oh, you know, there's two scenes in the film. There's a scene where Daniel Day-Lewis slaps me around, slaps my character around, and he drags me and puts me in the mud and shoves mud in my mouth, and then the very next day, we filmed a scene where I sort of get my revenge in church, and I baptize him, and I slap the devil out of him and the sin out of him. And luckily, we filmed those scenes 2 days back to back. So Daniel slapped me around one day, and then the very next day, I got to get my revenge. And the first take of the scene where I get to slap Daniel around, I was not supposed to actually slap him in the face because, you know, his face is going to get red, and we have to do multiple takes and coverage, and it's a long scene, so, you know, it's a few minutes long at least, and I guess once we got into it, I forgot, and I just slapped the hell out of his face
okay.
on the very first take, which was a lot of fun and very thrilling, but as soon as they yelled cut, I said to myself, oh boy, I was not supposed to do that, and I was sort of mortified and thrilled at the same time, but I think everybody else was thrilled because the scene was going well, and we were sort of having fun and getting into it.
What about being thrown in the mud? How did that feel?
Well, the first couple takes, we actually didn't do the mud thing. That got added in, conveniently added in for the people watching and not so conveniently for me. Originally, it was just some slapping around, and then we saw the mud off in the distance, and either Daniel or Paul said, well, he's got to go in the mud. And I said, okay, well, put me in the mud. And we just sort of... We did it. We did it on the last take, and then we said, well, that was really great, so let's hose them down and let's try and get another take in the mud, and then ended up making the film. So I guess it was worth eating a little mud.
My guest is Paul Dano, and he plays a boy preacher in the new film There Will Be Blood. Paul, a lot of people know you for your role in Little Miss Sunshine. And for our listeners who haven't seen that movie, it's about a dysfunctional family on their way to a kiddie beauty pageant that the daughter is going to compete in. And you're her older brother. And you've basically stopped talking for most of the movie because you're so angry with your family and so alienated from them. And what's it like to go through most of a movie not speaking?
It's funny. I've had numerous people say to me, oh, that must have been a lot easier to not have to talk. And it's the exact opposite. It was so much harder to have to contribute to a scene and be a part of a scene without saying anything. And it was a great challenge. And I don't even think I knew how hard it was going to be until, you know, you sort of got in the room and in front of the cameras and said, whoa, you know, we're doing an 8-page scene here and, you know, filming 5 minutes at a time, and I have to contribute to the scene without saying anything. And it was really, really a great learning experience for that reason, because a lot of acting is about listening. And I have to say I learned quite a bit doing that part.
Your ambition in this movie is to be a military test pilot, and on this road trip to kill time, your younger sister is giving you these vision tests, and it turns out that you're colorblind, and therefore you're not eligible to do what you want to do, which is become a test pilot. So when you find that out, you get hysterical, and you just start pounding the walls and the ceiling of the VW bus, and your father stops the car, you run down the side of the road screaming and weeping. And you're followed by your mother, who talks with you. She's played by Toni Collette. I want to play that scene.
Okay.
Dwayne? Dwayne, honey, I'm sorry. Dwayne, come on. We have to go.
I'm not going.
Dwayne...
I said I'm not. Okay, I don't care. I'm not getting on that bus again.
Dwayne, for better or worse, we're your family.
No, you're not my family. Okay, I don't want to be your family. I hate you people. I hate you. Divorce? Bankrupt? Suicide? You losers. You losers. Okay. No, please just leave me here, Mom. Okay? Please.
Terry, that was torture.
Yeah.
Torture listening to myself like that.
Why?
Oh, it's I do you not have this as a radio host listening to your own voice?
I do.
Yeah, I mean,
I
it's like a horrible...
I know.
It's, yeah, wow.
Yeah, I know. But you're so good at it. It's such a good performance. And I really like the way, you know, after not speaking for this whole film, basically, you just get unplugged. I mean, you just explode. And you're really, really upset, yet there's this slight comic edge to it. And that must have been a hard line to walk, to be like that angry, but to know that you're also in a comedy and there's a slight...
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it certainly was. I think the key to that, to me, the key to that film was that you sort of, if you take people to a sort of honest and real level of disappointment almost, the comedy that comes out of that is much truer and more relatable and therefore more funny, I think. And I think hopefully, you know, not laughing at always and sometimes laughing with. And I think it's a very fine line. And I think, you know, luckily the people who directed that, Jonathan Dayton and Valerie Faris, a lot of credit goes to them because it's really tough to make a film like that work, actually, which does sort of walk that line, because there is, as much of a comedy as it is, there is that that undertow of drama, and especially in a scene like that. And, you know, I felt in good hands and lucky to have them.
Now, you started acting on Broadway when you were 12. Do I have that right?
Yeah.
How did that happen? How did you get your first Broadway part?
You know, I always did plays all my life, but sort of as an activity. Like, I went to school. I went to normal school, and I'd go to soccer practice, and then I'd go to the local theater and do public theater for fun. But, you know, I was certainly – it was always important to me. I was always in school and still sort of playing sports and being a kid, you know, and doing a lot of stupid things. And I luckily also sort of got a head start on the acting career, but I don't know, even though I might have been doing some Broadway stuff when I was 12, 13, 14, I'm not sure that I saw it as a feasible thing to do as an adult.
How active were your parents in your early career?
Well, at that age, you have to legally have somebody there to, you know, sort of take care of you. You can't just show up at the theater when you're 12 and be there for hours unsupervised. So, you know, a lot of credit sort of goes to my parents for sort of putting up with that and supporting me. And they've been pretty tremendous throughout all this. I did my first film when I was 16, and it was a film that was not not the kindest subject. It was sort of a it involved a pedophile. It was this film called L.I.E., and Brian Cox played this sort of pedophile, and it's a really wonderful film, actually. But they were completely open to me wanting to do this, which is, you know, sort of rare. Their encouragement has been really important. I don't think I probably give them enough credit. I hope they listen to this. I got to tell them to listen to this, because they'll appreciate hearing me say that, because I'm not sure I say it to them enough. But I guess they played an important part of it. But they certainly didn't encourage me not to do things, but they certainly didn't over-encourage me to do things either.
Were your parents involved in theater? What did they do professionally?
No, my dad was a businessman, and my mom worked, but once she had me and my sister, she just took care of us. And I don't know where it came from. They're both they're terrible actors, and they can't sing, and they really don't watch good films or anything. So I'm not sure where it came from, or even my interest. I'm not even sure where that came from. I think it was just something I was drawn to.
Well, Paul Dano, thanks so much for talking with us.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Paul Dano, speaking to Terry Gross earlier this year. His movie, There Will Be Blood, will be released on DVD early next month. This is Fresh Air.
Hey, what's your name anyhow?
Clyde Barron.
Hi, I'm Bonnie Parker. Pleased to meet you.
A special 40th anniversary DVD edition of Bonnie and Clyde has just been released. And in a moment, we'll visit with Arthur Penn, director of that landmark 1967 film. But first, let's hear another clip. This is the scene where Bonnie Parker, played by Faye Dunaway, meets Clyde Barrow, played by Warren Beatty. He robs banks, but she doesn't believe him, at least not until he pulls out his gun in the middle of the street and lets her touch it.
What's it like?
Aren't you in prison?
No. Armed robbery.
Ain't like anything.
Shoot, I knew you never robbed the place, you faker. Yeah. But you wouldn't have the gumption to use it.
You just wait right here and you keep your eyes open.
40 years after Bonnie and Clyde was produced, the death scene ending of that film remains as brutal and visceral and oddly beautiful as it was back in 1967 when Arthur Penn directed it. The scene influenced how generations of filmmakers have approached and choreographed violence on the screen. A Hollywood and Broadway veteran, Penn also directed The Left-Handed Gun, The Miracle Worker, Mickey One, Alice's Restaurant, Little Big Man, and The Missouri Breaks. Terry Gross spoke with Arthur Penn in 1989.
I want to go back to 1967 when you made Bonnie and Clyde, which was really a landmark film in part because of how you handled the violence in it, particularly the scene at the end where Bonnie and Clyde each take dozens of bullets and their bodies twitch with the impact long after they're dead. This film led Pauline Kael to say, Penn has a gift for violence. Despite all the violence in movies, a gift for violence is rare. Did you think of yourself that way, as having that gift?
No, I wouldn't have defined it that way, but I guess you have to understand that we were operating, of course, in a totally different social context in those days. It was in the midst of the Vietnamese War, And Daily News, the news of that we saw on television, had body counts and numbers of soldiers wounded and dead. And it was a time where it seemed to me that if we were going to depict violence, that we would be obliged really to depict it accurately with the kind of terrible, frightening volume that that one sees when one genuinely is confronted by violence.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we did in Bonnie and Clyde. Also, we were doing it at the same time with a kind of, at the end of the film, with an attempt to raise these two characters to a kind of faintly mythic proportion. So it was done in an extraordinarily complicated technical way, but the end result was to sort of propel them upward into myth, and that was the attempt, at least. And to some degree, I think we succeeded. We also succeeded in upsetting an awful lot of people.
Yeah. Can I ask you how you choreographed and shot that last sequence where Bonnie and Clyde are murdered with dozens of bullets?
Yes, but I'm afraid it'll be hopelessly technically difficult. Let me try and give you a short volume answer, okay?
Oh, please, yeah.
All right. One of the things that I attempted to do was to have it in different speeds. And the way you achieve slow motion in film is by actually running the film faster so that many more frames are exposed. And that's what produces slow motion. So the intention there was to get this kind of spastic motion of genuine violence at the same time the attenuation of time that one experiences when you see something like a terrible automobile accident or, in my case, certain occurrences in the war. It was this extraordinary stretch of time while these events were taking place. And so what I did was I ganged four cameras together, all running at different speeds, some at very, very, very high speed, and some at just double normal speed, some at four times normal speed. It was to get this kind of spastic, balletic violence. That was really the attempt, to really join time and space. And that's how we did it, in layman's terms, without getting into the technical aspects of it too deeply.
Now, I was just running back that scene last night, and I think the part where you really see the slowed-down action is just when Warren Beatty takes the first bullet and falls to the ground.
You were aware of it there, but it runs all the way through the scene.
So
it's all done in different time motions,
mm-hmm.
all the way through to the very end of the scene, including Faye falling in the car and her hands slowly bouncing, and then stopping.
Mm-hmm.
All of that was done by these four cameras in different speeds.
Correct me if I'm wrong, the sound of the bullet sounds like it's real time.
Exactly. We kept that. We decided to do it. I decided to do it. At a visual expansion of time and an auditory continuum of time in normal, apparently normal extension of time.
What, for disorientation?
No, actually for orientation. I thought if we disoriented the sound as well as we disoriented the film, that we would then be clearly engaged in the movie aspect of it. And I didn't want you particularly to be aware of the medium at that point. I was hoping that you would be caught totally by the nature of the action on the screen.
Was there a code in existence at the time that you made Bonnie and Clyde?
Oh, yes.
What did the code say about violence, and did you have any problem getting the film through? Because for its time, it was extreme.
No, may I try to correct a couple of things?
Yeah, please, yeah.
Yeah, first of all, it was not extreme. What it was that it became a cause célèbre because the critic at that time of the New York Times had decided to engage in a campaign against what he perceived as violence in films. And he was really objecting to many other kinds of films. When this came along, however, it provided him with the perfect launching pad for a real diatribe against our film and violence in film. And somehow we remained tainted with that. Now, he's talking about one kind of violence. Pauline Kael is talking about another.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Pauline Kael's kind of violence that I'm really responding to with accuracy and complimentary.
Talking about Kael here, let me quote her again. She says that you put the sting back in death.
Well, as I say, in a context of the times where we were seeing it on the 6 o'clock news all over the country, bodies, helicopters crashing, people being killed, young men being rushed to the ambulances, there was a kind of desensitization in the nation to violence. And it seemed to us, to me, that it was important to depict it as it really is.
Arthur Penn, speaking to Terry Gross in 1989. Bonnie and Clyde has just been re-released on DVD in a new 40th anniversary special edition. 9 years after Kimberly Pierce's acclaimed independent first film, Boys Don't Cry, the director teamed up with Paramount and MTV Films to make the new drama Stop Loss. The title refers to the government policy, invoked during times of war, that keeps soldiers in the military past the date when their service was supposed to end. The film stars Ryan Phillippe, Abby Cornish, and Joseph Gordon-Levitt. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
At first glance, Kimberly Pierce's Stop Loss doesn't bear much resemblance to her momentous debut, Boys Don't Cry, the story of a young woman who pretends joyfully to be a man, and when she's discovered, is raped and murdered. But the films are connected. Pierce has a knack for getting inside the heads of young men, for illuminating their bonds and rituals in a way that should be the envy of male directors. Last year's Iraq and War on Terror movies tanked, and you wouldn't know this is a political film from the posters, which feature four young people staring into the camera like John Hughes characters contemplating the senior prom. But in a sometimes live-wire, sometimes ungainly way, Stop Loss evokes the pain of young American cowboy types who've lost all sense of autonomy. The movie centers on three Texas soldiers, good old boys, who return from Iraq right after an ambush that left some of their buddies dead and maimed, and another grimly stoic after inadvertently killing women and children. That's the opening sequence, and Pierce makes you understand the adrenaline-fueled hyper-awareness of these men at a checkpoint as they almost fire on a family speeding toward them, then the unreality of the moment when insurgents in another speeding car suddenly open fire on them. They make split-second and not too wise decisions as the insurgents melt into civilian crowds. And when it's all over, and they roll into Texas on a bus, ready to be discharged, you get a palpable sense of how wound up they are, how they're itching to get very, very drunk and have crazy sex and court oblivion. They barely make it through the parade and the welcome speech of a U.S. senator before they're throwing back shots and retching and punching people out. The first night home, Tommy, played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt, gets thrown out by his wife. Steve, played by Channing Tatum, backhands his fiancée, Michelle, played by Abby Cornish, and begins to dig a trench in the yard while screaming he's under fire. Brandon, played by Ryan Phillippe, seems the most stable until he goes back on the base to get his discharge papers.
Says here you have orders to report to the 1st Brigade.
Not me. I'm getting out today.
Brandon Leonard King?
Yes.
Out to the 1st Brigade on the 22nd.
This is a mistake.
It's all there. You leave on the 22nd, shipping back to Iraq. Subsection 12305, Title 10, by the authority of the President. You've been stop lost.
Ryan Phillippe has never struck me as much of an actor, but in Stop Loss, he's very impressive, convincingly edgy and disoriented. He tells his commanding officer no, he's not going back. He punches out two guards. He goes AWOL. He can't believe what's happening, and neither can his mother, played by Linda Emmon, and his pal Steve's fiance, Michelle.
They stop lost you. How can they do this?
They're doing whatever they want to do. With a shortage of guys and no draft, they're shipping back soldiers who're supposed to be getting out. It's a backdoor draft is what it is.
What about Steve?
Mitch, I don't know. Some of us are getting it, some ain't.
This cannot be happening. No, you almost died over there. What do you want to do? You want me to take you to Mexico till this blows over?
No. Out of the question, Mom. I ain't dragging my tail across to Mexico.
I'll take you.
Michelle does drive him. Not to Mexico, but to Washington, where he hopes the senator who once promised him the world will stop the stop loss. It's during Michelle and Brandon's road trip that stop loss loses momentum. There's lots of talk, and lots of shots of their car going over bridges. But this is the bitter core of the film, and it should be crawly and discomforting. A visit to the family of a dead comrade, to their hospitalized buddy, Rico, played by Victor Razzak, who's blind and has lost one arm and two legs, and to a fleabag motel where another AWOL stop-loss soldier hides with his wife and sick child. The young Australian actress Abby Cornish makes Michelle, potentially a thankless role, a vivid observer. She's struggling to understand what Iraq and stop-loss, a changing of the rules in midstream, means to men who thought in war you knew who the bad guys were, and when you were out, you were out. Brandon has no real recourse, and Pierce has no answers. The power of the film, and this is no joke, is that it shows him between Iraq and a hard place.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.